This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The U.S. has announced that it will draft a second U.N. resolution, which is expected to declare Iraq in material breach of the disarmament resolution passed last November. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Ian Williams, U.N. correspondent for The Nation magazine. Mr. Williams, given the fact that the U.S. is now drafting a second U.N. resolution, I guess the world can assume that we're not going to go in on the strength of 1441 alone.
I think the rest of the world has made the point very strongly that if the U.S. does this, it cannot claim to be acting in the name of the United Nations or the global community. It doesn't mean to say that the U.S. won't go in, but there's no way that they can do it with any legitimacy. You've already seen the horse trading today with the Turks, who are, in effect, they've got the bill up to, I think it's, what, $36 billion so far, cash up front, and they want more if they're prepared to cooperate without a U.N. resolution.
Mm. And so what is this second resolution likely to say that's different from 1441 with respect to the issue of use of military force?
This time it is, the signs are, and it's being negotiated between the British and the Americans at the moment, it was the British who insisted, the signs are that it will be asking for a specific set of benchmarks to be met by Iraq within a certain timetable. It's in effect, it's an ultimatum. So I can't be sure, because no one's seen it, but mm-hmm. I suspect that Iraq will be asked to provide definitive evidence about what it did with all of those 8,000 liters of anthrax and all of the other things that they admitted that they had, but have sort of somehow mislaid mm-hmm. in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the inspectors have already shown unhappiness about this, because the Iraqis have just said, oh, well, we got rid of it. But they haven't produced any documentation or evidence or witnesses or sites where the stuff was got rid of. And, you know, getting rid of 8,000 liters of anthrax, it's not like pouring Drano down the drain.
Flushing it down the toilet. So we know the Pentagon has already got about 150,000 troops amassed in the region as we speak, and that ships are carrying heavy equipment and supplies for those troops, and they're reportedly sitting in the Mediterranean waiting for a signal to dock in Turkey. And given that scenario, does putting off the vote until early March delay the Pentagon's attack plans significantly?
Well, interestingly, this morning in the London Times, General Wesley Clark had an article. He's an ex-general now, but he says that the troops aren't ready, that they're not in position yet, and they won't be until the middle of March, because there's been hold-ups in getting the, you know, there's immense logistical problems here in getting their equipment and the backup necessary for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that puts some sense in why the U.S. was prepared to go for a second resolution, because their deadline is the increasing temperature in the desert, which is sort of by April begins to be pretty insufferable. And so the wiggle room here is sometime towards the end of March for a sort of resolution and a deadline.
And so the weather is a factor because of the heavy equipment that the U.S. soldiers would be required to wear to protect them from chemical and biological attacks?
That's a very significant factor. If you saw the one of the soldiers demonstrating this keeled over with the heat in midwinter in the U.S., so what it would be like wearing one of these things in that temperature in the desert for any extended length of period is, it doesn't bear contemplating.
What kind of temperatures are we talking about in April? In
105 and upwards, I gather, and rising. In fact, one person I spoke to dismissed this because he said most of their fighting will be done at night anyway, so it will be cooler. But that's another view. They still have to exist there, and it means that they can't. That they've got to hang about in those suits. But mm-hmm. between Hans Blix and Al Baradei reporting back sometime 3rd or 4th of March and the end of March seems to be the sort of the timetable we're talking about for this resolution to be considered and pushed ahead.
Mm. Now, President Bush insist he will go it alone or with the quote-unquote coalition of the willing if he doesn't get the U.N. support. And given the response from the Security Council last Friday, it doesn't appear as though he'll get the crucial support from France and Germany. Moreover, Secretary of State Colin Powell basically accused the two countries of being too cowardly to go to war when he said, quote, certain countries are afraid of upholding their responsibility to impose the will of the international community, unquote. Now, there are 15 members on the Security Council, but if France and Germany veto, is it over for the U.S. with regard to this new resolution?
Complex question. If the French were to veto it, it would be over as far as this resolution were concerned. But there's two points there. One is, it's this type of rhetoric which is hardening French resistance. I mean, the French were the ones who provided tens of thousands of peacekeepers in Bosnia when the U.S. refused to commit ground troops. They lost hundreds of people in that war. They didn't always have a glorious role, I agree. But they and the British were prepared to provide ground troops to for an assault on Kosovo at a time when the U.S. refused to provide ground troops. So going around accusing them of cowardice, I think, is not going to go down very well as being contrafactual. But in fact, it means that the U.S. once again isn't listening. What President Chirac of France said this week, he didn't say no resolution. He said no resolution today. And the French foreign minister in the Security Council, who got applauded for his elegant and eloquent speech against pointing out the war is the very final resort, very strongly pointed out that it was the final resort, but it was a resort that still had to be kept there if Iraq doesn't cooperate. So the French are busily sending signals saying we're prepared to consider reasonable offers, and their response from Washington is basically a large finger pointed up in the air in their direction.
Now, which finger might that be, Ian?
Somewhere around the middle.
Ian, any final thoughts on your part?
The whole episode shows that American diplomacy is a total oxymoron. It's a contradiction in terms. The idea that you can let people like Bolton around the world to advance your cause is really frightening. I don't know whether you saw this week, Undersecretary of State for Disarmament was in Israel saying that after we finish with Iraq, it's on to Iran and on to Syria.
Oh,
now, you know, I'm sorry, this is sort of, if I were a reservist on my way to the Gulf, I'd be asking very seriously when I could expect to come back home. It's a long way to Tehran.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be an easy ride to Damascus. And here you have a senior U.S. official, without much comment in the U.S. press, going around threatening sort of wars unending in places all over the world. And nobody seems to be listening here. But people abroad are listening, and they're watching, and they're weighing this. Every time the question comes up that Iraq is just for disarmament and enforcement of UN resolutions, and they'll say, and which UN resolutions will they be enforcing in Iran?
Ian Williams, UN correspondent for The Nation magazine. Iraqi, Kuwaiti, and Saudi officials held talks in Amman, Jordan, on the fate of hundreds of civilian and military personnel missing since the 1990-91 Gulf War. This is the 54th meeting between the representatives of the three governments under the sponsorship of the International Committee of the Red Cross. Kuwait claims 605 of its citizens are missing in Iraq, while the latter alleges Kuwait is holding more than 1,000 Iraqis. From Amman, Ula Farawati reports.
It's a war of words between Iraq and Kuwaiti officials meeting in Amman. The two sides came to Jordan to discuss the issue of Kuwaiti and Iraqi prisoners of war. Both parties are trading accusations of lack of cooperation and playing political tricks in a time when Iraq is being threatened of a military attack.
We are aware of Iraq manipulations. Iraq is only trying to gain time.
Head of the Kuwaiti Information Center in Amman, Hamid Mtairi.
Unfortunately, we haven't made any steps forward in the three meetings we had in Amman. We are hearing the same answers from Iraq over and over again. They keep denying they are holding any Kuwaiti prisoners.
No Iraqi officials were immediately available for comment, but head of the Iraqi delegation to the talks, Abdel Manam Qadi, told Agence France-Presse that Iraq is showing full cooperation. He said that the Iraqi delegation provided precise documents on the fate of one of the Kuwaiti missing and promised to hand over six others. He added that the Iraqi representatives proposed setting up a commission to find the remains of thousands of Iraqis missing since the war. Iraq raised the issue of Iraqi missing and prisoners of war in 1996, 5 years after the pullout of Iraqi troops from Kuwait. Spokesperson for the ICRC in Amman, Ma'in Qassis, speaks about the issue.
We are discussing the fate in this committee, the fate of all persons missing. The role of the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, is to try to act as a neutral intermediary. So it receives figures and files presented by this group or this country and files presented by the other country. So in other words, the Kuwaitis have submitted information about reported missing persons, and the Iraqis have, and the Americans have, and the Saudis have. Some of these missing persons were found dead, and their remains were uncovered and repatriated to their countries to be buried there.
Analysts believe this issue cannot be solved with a possible war in the horizon. Well-known columnist Basir Rafaa doubts that the two sides will be able to come to terms.
I think this issue is being deliberately used against Iraq, especially at this time when Iraq is being threatened. There are countries like the U.S. which are using this against Iraq. The United States has always accused Iraq of flagrant violations of human rights, especially at this tense situation.
هناك أسرى لدى العراق وأن العراق الذي تتهمه الولايات المتحدة بانتهاكات مستمرة لحقوق الإنسان.
He adds that there are more important matters to be discussed at this point between the two countries.
Before discussing this matter, both countries have to think systematically of how to build new relationships that are completely detached from what happened in the past. After that, solving the issue of the prisoners would become easier. Both parties now have to think of the border problem, security, and the Iraqi recognition of the sovereignty of Kuwait. Both countries should enter a complete normalization with each other, after which this issue will be solved and simmered down from the tense relationship now in place.
أن يدخل البلدان في إجراءات لتطبيع العلاقات بينهما ليكتشف بعد ذلك أن قضية الأسرى والمفقودين قضية يمكن حلها.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Ola Farawati from Amman.
Over the past several weeks on Peace Watch, we've featured voices of artists, poets, and musicians offering creative responses to the war with Iraq. From Amman, Jordan, correspondent Erin Glantz profiles three Arab women authors against the war.
Shala Al-Khayali is about to board a bus to Baghdad. The 63-year-old Palestinian-born poet is part of a delegation heading to the Iraqi capital for a solidarity conference for Iraqi youth. Al-Khayali has been living in Jordan since the State of Israel was declared in 1948. She says she was forced from her home in Al-Lud at gunpoint. She says she has a special place in her heart for Saddam Hussein.
I have the key, and the key has been with me more than 52 years. I carried it around my neck for 52 years. I gave the key to the Iraqi president Saddam Hussein in last year because Saddam Hussein is always in his speeches, he says, Allahu Akbar, Palestine is Arabic, from the Mediterranean Sea to the river Euphrates. And Saddam Hussein, he never forgets the Palestinian problem, even in 1980. I came with my life. The keys of my home, the key in my hand, and the key of my refugee status. And I am in agony for half a century. And my house door is closed. This is the old house. They closed it more than 50 years ago. They led me out by force, by the hand, and moved me from Al-Lud in Palestine. This conspiracy against the Arabs does not surprise me. It doesn't seem strange when Tony Blair follows George Bush. Tony Blair is like the grandson of Balfour. And he started the problem for the Palestinians when he gave the land to the Jews.
When asked which of her poems represents how she feels about Iraq, Al-Khayali picks one she wrote in 1988 called The Palestinian Child in the International Year of the Child. She reads aboard the bus as it heads from Amman to Baghdad.
أطفال العالم مبتهجون.
The children of the world are rejoicing. The children of the world are celebrating the year of the child, the year of love, the smile at the year of the child. The children of the world are implanted like strong roots in the earth. For each there is a country and a cause. For each there is a flag and identity. For each there is an eternal sun.
من أين؟ But I من أين سأبدأ محتفلا؟
Where shall I start celebrating
while my home
is in exile?
أنا طفل.
Oh, أنا طفل international year of the child.
سرقوا ألعابي وطعامي.
I am a child who is a victim of injustice. They stole my toys and my food and sang in the name of freedom. Oh, international year of the child. The Supreme Court of Justice in the occupied land of the Arabs. In the year of the child and in March issued a decree concerning me, a grown man, responsible to all the laws. I am proud of the procedure. I am a child, but grown up in the international year of the child.
أنا طفل.
أنا طفل للظلم
ضحية. سرقوا ألعابي
وطعامي. I raise my voice in protest. And make mankind hear my voice. For I am assassinated in my country. They have robbed me of my heritage and legacy. They have taken from my mother, my brother's milk. Nothing remains of my mother. And my brother is one of your children. Oh, international year of the child.
Miriam Saifi is another Palestinian-born poet who fled to Jordan under the gun of Israeli forces in 1948. She has written a new poem for Iraq. In the poem, she addresses an Iraqi who is leaving his home behind because of the threat of war.
لماذا الرحيل؟ لماذا الرحيل؟ وما زال في الأفق متسع للأماني؟ وما زال فيه فضاء؟
Where are you going? There is a dignity in your chest in which Iraq is growing and remains a place where the bleeding stars bleed loneliness to your letters that are baying in sadness and loneliness and nostalgia. Where are you leaving? Why leaving? And in the horizon, there is room for wishes in the tender-hearted space in which wishes are flying. The sun is shining, the bird is still singing, and the branch is still flowering, and the mind is still abundant with giving. And in the clouds, there is happiness. And the tigress is still holding the passions of the pioneers who crossed it, and the star of Iraq is still staunchly defending itself from the dying aggressors.
الذي رحل عن العراق في هذه الظروف واقول له ان
Saifi says she wrote the poem after watching hundreds of thousands of Iraqis cross the country's western desert to Jordan. There are 300,000 Iraqi families living in Jordan today. A staggering figure when one considers Jordan's total population is only a bit more than 5 million. She says the poem is meant to show Iraqis there are many spaces in Iraq to turn back to. She says there is a light there for Iraq and the whole world. Saifi pauses and speaks in English. She wants to make sure listeners know she loves Saddam Hussein. She says she loves Saddam Hussein because he is against Israel. She says Saddam Hussein is a hero.
Saddam Hussein, he is a good man. The Saddam Hussein want to bring peace for Palestine. And everything for all, for the world, everybody in the world. He didn't go to America to fight them. He is in his country. Why they want to come from America and fight Saddam Hussein in his country?
This is by no means a universally held belief in the Arab world. But despite his long record of human rights abuses, the Iraqi president is admired by many for his Scud missile attacks on Tel Aviv in 1991 and his refusal to negotiate any agreements with Israel. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in Amman, Jordan.
As the world prepared to gather for the global protest on February 15th last weekend against the Bush administration's plan to attack Iraq, Diane Wilson, a fourth-generation shrimper and environmental human rights activist from Seadrift, Texas, was gearing herself up for direct action of her own. The target? The United Nations building in New York City, the site of the nation's biggest anti-war protest last weekend. Wilson is no stranger to direct actions. In August of 2002, she chained herself to a Dow chemical tower in Seadrift, Texas, as part of the Bhopal, India campaign to hold the multinational corporation Dow Chemical, responsible for the cleanup of the Bhopal chemical disaster site in India. Wilson recently returned from Iraq with Global Exchange co-founder Medea Benjamin and other women from the women's peace group Code Pink. In an interview with Jackson Allers of Houston Pacifica Station KPFT, Wilson discusses her experience in Iraq. This, as another Texan sitting in the White House, continues the military buildup in the Persian Gulf.
Why did you go to Iraq, Diane?
Probably because I wanted to see for myself what it was like over there. Because if you listen to the news, you know, like for instance, last night I went to a friend's home and I saw underneath all this newscast is this terror alert, high alert, you know, and it's this whole thing is this about terrorists and about axis of evil, and it just tends to demonize a whole country, a whole nation, and I've learned enough to question things and to doubt what people tell me and to check it out for myself.
And the Iraqi people, how are the Iraqi people towards you, considering that we could bomb innocent civilians, children, men, women, at any time?
All we received from them was friendliness, openness. They always offered us tea. And I mean, it wasn't like it was staged, because we walked down alleys of Baghdad. A couple of times I got lost and walked around Baghdad all by myself. And all I had was these people that would come up and help me find my way, offer me tea. And when they found out you were American, their face would open up. They would smile. And I remember one man, we went to Babylon, and he saw me on the street and he came up to me and he spoke some English. So he started talking about what they feared and how they worried about the war. And he had a picture. We got a picture together of me putting my hand on his arm. And he said, oh, his mother would be real pleased to see me with my hand on his arm. And when we were finished, he said, you women are something. He said, but your government is something else. And so the real intriguing thing is they can separate the American public from our government. You know, and I don't think America is that compassionate. I don't think we separate the people from the government or Saddam Hussein. And, you know, and I think that's what the government's trying to do, is trying to demonize an entire race of people. And I guarantee it's a falsehood. It's a lie. And all these are very vulnerable people. The alleys were filled with children. And so when they talk about intense urban fighting and going into the alleys and fighting, that's going to be children they're going to be aiming at.
Well, Diane, how about linking your own environmental work to what you were able to do there? How did that play in?
Well, I tell you what, I learned something over there. And this is something I didn't realize, is that here our big deal in the government is just like the air pollution and all that. I went over there, and we went to one of the oil refineries. As a matter of fact, we gave blood at the oil refineries, kind of doing a takeoff on that blood could be used for a life-giving thing. It shouldn't be used for oil. And that, I know there was this oil refinery, and it was 50 years old, and there was the biggest, blackest, billowing cloud, and I mean in Texas, brother, you see that and you know you got nothing but hydrocarbons coming out, cancerous stuff. And over there, you can't get any type of new technology. You can't get scrubbers. You can't get this anti-smog devices because it's economic sanctions. There is no way. Matter of fact, the children can't even get pencils because they won't allow the lead. And so here you are. I mean, you're creating not only this hardship on the people, but you're creating this horrible pollution. And for instance, all of the infrastructures for the wastewaters, for the drinking water, I mean, they're non-existent. You can't drink the water, and everything is just going straight into the rivers. And the people are naturally having to survive. The only protein they can get is probably from the fish, because most of them, oh, there's a tremendous amount of people that are dependent on the government for subsidies. That is the only way they survive. And this is the type of stuff like you know, like Medicaid in the United States, except it's the very basic, and they admit that the people suffer from malnutrition because it's only the very basic, and it doesn't even help a minimum requirement on your health.
Could you explain the visit that you made to the hospital? What did you see there?
We had a kind of talk with, he was a physician, but he was also the administrator, and he was talking how difficult it was to take care of the health of the people because, especially of the economic sanctions that they have been having for 12 years. And he was talking about, like in the case of a possible war, they've got one ambulance per 30,000 people. They've got like 50 doctors per 100,000 people. So there is no way they can take care of it. They were already in a crisis. We went down to the children's ward, like I said, the ones that were dying of cancers, because we spoke to some of the women there that were sitting with their children. And a lot of them blamed it on that depleted uranium that they had been using, you know, on the munitions. The cancer rates are up. Cancer that normally happens in a much older rate is now down in like 10 and 12-year-olds, and these people can do nothing. And I remember this one little boy, he was dying with leukemia, and then the doctor said, you know, he has no hope because he can't receive the proper medicine, and what they're using, it was making his skin peel. And he was just pained. It was pitiful.
نامي نامي يا صغيرة يلا غفي على الحصيرة.
Texas activist Diane Wilson speaking with KPFT producer Jackson Allers. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Aaron Glantz, Lucy Murphy, and Benta Brooklyn. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback at Pacifica's Peace Watch, peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.